Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, your butt at the party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur, sitting in the Duck South Studios on this warm, moist. How are your feelings about moist, Vince? You like that word?
Moist is... Yeah. I don't have any problem with that word. It's a very good descriptive adjective. I don't know many men who like that word, who don't like that word, but I know a few women who don't like that word.
Some people that freak out.
I don't know.
Word moist.
Yeah, some people do really kind of. It's a strange word. It's a very polarizing, dividing word. I don't have any problem with it.
Hey, you know what? You know what's polarizing? And I hadn't talked to you about this. In the times that we've texted and been in a group message, blah, 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 talked on the phone, or even last week, before the podcast last week, you know what I've caught hell about throughout the Thunder Rolls podcast series?
Oh, gracious, what?
The statement that I made about wearing an eye patch. You know how many messages? I got like 4 messages over the eye patch deal.
Really? Like giving you a hard time, like you shouldn't have said that?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. If you heard how much grief my kids give me about, ooh, Dad, you can't see me. I'm on your bad side. You know, stuff like that. Like, I mean, an eye patch is nothing. I mean, I wish that if somebody came up with an eye patch that didn't feel like you were wearing an eye patch, I'd wear one. I mean, that's cool. That's really, really cool stuff right there. But the way the strap goes across the back of your head just messes up your hair. And, I mean, it's not comfortable to wear an eye patch, but if it was, you can bet your butt
I'd own that one for sure.
I could not believe that somebody took time out of their day to private message me.
Yeah, you just don't know what wearing an eye patch is like. You're an idiot.
I'm like, oh my God. Dude, I was referring to, if you knew the backstory to what we were saying, and I think I edited it out, I was talking about the episode where Kramer wore the eye patch to pick up women on Seinfeld. Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, sort of. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to wear an eye patch for medical reasons. I was just, you know.
Yeah.
Referencing that.
No, I get it. Good. I've often thought about, instead of an eye patch, that what I might do is I might just be one of those people that wears Costas all the time, you know, 24/7 inside, and then just kind of, that way people don't know whether you're blind or whether you're just hiding something, or, you know, but I don't know. I hadn't got there yet. We'll see. One of these days, maybe.
Would you go with the highly reflective Costas, or would you just go with the minimal shaded Costas?
I'd probably definitely not minimal shaded, because if you're going to wear sunglasses, you don't need people to know where your eyes are going. I mean, we've all been a teenage boy on the beach with our folks, and you know, you wear your sunglasses so they do not know what you're staring at. And so I would definitely not go with the minimally shaded. I believe that the way I would approach the situation would be, I'd have multiple pairs and I would wear them kind of like mood rings. So on some days I'd wear the blue reflectives, and some days it'd be like the peacock green reflective, and some days it'd be rose, and, you know, just never know.
So. So you would go with the full mirror, full frontal mirror.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Coast of course. Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure.
All right. So what's been happening this week before we jump back into the story? Tell me a little bit about what's been going on.
Man.
And.
Well, we got back from Kansas. Yeah, we got back from Kansas last Thursday night, super late. We hunted at White Oaks for a couple days, and that was good. And then with Jeff Farmer and Keith Allen, that was awesome. Just that opportunity was incredible. Real seriously, like a real bucket list thing to call ducks with Keith Allen and see Jeff's place. And then I guess Monday I went to work. And Tuesday I went and hunted a farm up, almost on the Missouri Arkansas line that, a friend of mine acquired, and we just went up there to see if there were any ducks, and it was froze up, and, he has risers out in front of the blind. So it's both the risers were, the pump was on, risers were supposed to be open, but somehow the risers were closed. So we drove all the way up there and froze out on Tuesday. Wednesday, I don't know what I did Wednesday. Thursday, shot a limit in the rain and four guys, and it was okay, but it was miserable rain. And today I took Miss Lindy to breakfast, so just kind of been a slow paced, easy week. No idea what I'm going to do next week in the sunshine, 60 degrees. I may try to follow Rob Kroom around.
Hey, you haven't been giving him a hard time, have
you? Not in public. Not in public. You got to, Rob's a special person. You got to be gentle with Rob. I mean, it's not very often that you're going to get one over on Rob. And so when you do, you just kind of need to, you know, let him digest it. You can't keep rubbing it in, because he's going to get back on top for long. And when he gets back on top, you're going to hear about it three times more than however you doled it out. So.
See, that's what I'm worried about in my whole troll job of Rob with the whole boat and selling 1,000 phone calls, because I know it's coming. Him and Jesse are plotting right now.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's multiple. Like, that's just your traditional troll job of Rob. He can handle that. But if you kill more ducks than him and you start trolling him about how much better you're doing duck killing than him, that's where the line is. And you won't stay on the winning side of that line very long, because, one, Rob really probably will kill more ducks than most of us see in our life. And two, if you're killing more than him right now, it won't be but a couple days and he'll be back on top, and then you'll have to hear about it. That's what I mean. So you probably don't have to worry about a troll job until February, because he'll stay busy enough until February, March. But by then you'll forget about it, and he'll figure something out. He'll get you back.
That is the truth, though, in the ducks, because I don't think that, you know, with all the joking and kidding around that Rob does, that son of a gun is a freaking killer.
Yeah, he's definitely got some fantastic places, and he knows how and when to hunt them. And I mean, yeah, he's got some awesome places to hunt. He definitely kills a lot of ducks.
All right, well, Spence, we took a week off. I'm glad we did, because last week's episode was unreal from a download numbers. And I knew it would be, because your webisode touched and hit so many people when they saw that. Father, son, and his son, three generation of hunters being out in the field. Now, I knew that we had to talk about that. That's important to me. That's where our hunting is going to keep going.
And yeah, that's right.
It touched emotionally a lot of people watching that. Great, great episode.
Yeah.
We kind of had to skip out on the story last week to talk about that. But a few weeks back, we left the story and you were in St. Louis.
Yep.
You owe United Healthcare $10,000.
Yeah, give or take.
I don't work.
Yeah.
Going to seminary, yep, that's right. And Lindy is kind of falling ill.
Yeah. Yeah, so I had my health care plan at the time. My health insurance was a major medical plan, and I had a $10,000 deductible. And so we went down for the first surgery and then the subsequent surgery and all that. We maxed that thing out real quick because these were highly specialized surgical procedures and a lot of post-op follow-up care and whatever. And I mean, we owed a ton of money, had no idea how we're going to pay it. And that was in the fall of the year. So my care kept going into the spring. But for that, at that point in time, that fall, I owed 10 grand. I had no job and, I was trying to do seminary and Lindy, you know, stress takes a real toll on your body. And the situation that we were in was just incredibly stressful because we couldn't see a way out. You know, we couldn't see how we were going to pay this back, how we were going to dig out of this hole. And so Lindy just kind of, I don't know, for her, it was hard on her physically. And she started having some pretty tough symptoms that she didn't understand and went to the doctor and they couldn't figure it out. And they ran blood tests and did different things. And they thought that some of her symptoms were similar to Crohn's disease, which is an autoimmune disease. And autoimmune, basically, I may get this wrong if there's some doctors listening, but probably doctors actually have a job and are working. So people listening are not doctors. And hopefully they won't be able to prove me wrong here, but an autoimmune disease is basically where your body does opposite of what it's supposed to do. And so it's very hard to treat. There's almost no treatment for most autoimmune diseases. You just treat symptoms because if your body is basically operating opposite of what it's supposed to do, then giving it meds doesn't generally make it respond because your body's kind of in a backwards response pattern, if that makes sense. And, so long story short, the folks in St. Louis put Lindy on a couple of steroids and an anti-inflammatory pill and then a whole bunch of antibiotics. And the combination of those things, it was like 12 or 14 pills, combination of those things just made her just deathly ill. I mean, just nauseous all the time. And just couldn't function. And so we had, Maddie was about 4 at the time. I'd say Katie was 2, maybe 5 and 3, something like that. Maddie wasn't in kindergarten yet. She was in pre-K. And I was trying to take classes with, you know, a bum eye that hurt and barely functional and trying to translate Hebrew. It just didn't work. We kept driving back and forth from St. Louis to Memphis to get checkups on my eye and things just were spiraling kind of out of, to a place where we didn't have a solution to these things that were going on. I couldn't keep doing class with my eye, but even worse, I couldn't go to class because Lindy couldn't function well enough to take care of the kids. And so I went and talked to the, so we had this conundrum, okay? That's kind of where we were, where we left it off. Well, let me back up. So that would have been the fall of 2009, okay, that this was going on, summer and fall of 2009. And in that window of time, that summer, I had started tinkering with building an injection mold to replicate the ults that I was cutting for people. And I had some friends that liked them, and you know, I'm not going to say it was a big deal, but I had a little, you know, I had a group of friends and people and whatever that wanted me to cut them an ult, and we all hunted with them. and the price to find an old on eBay was just astronomical. I mean, it was, you know, $150 for an unmodified old keyhole alt. And so people would buy them, and they'd send them to me, and it was just kind of a little side job. I'd make a little money, but I really wasn't charging anybody to do it. I was just doing it because I enjoyed it, and it wasn't really a business. And one of my best friends, a guy from that, I mean, I went to kindergarten all the way through with this guy's name is Wes Reed. And Wes, in college, went to Christian Brothers University and got a degree in engineering. And Wes was working for a company called Wright Medical in Memphis, Tennessee, or in Arlington. And Wright Medical made orthopedic parts and joint implants and all these different things. And Wes was all up in the middle of the regulatory affairs division for new product development. And so he was around all these people that took a concept and turned it into reality through injection molding, through CNC machine work, through 3D printing, and that was way cutting edge in 2006, 7, 8. I mean, there were just a few companies that had access to that kind of equipment. And so we were kind of talking about it, and Wes was really geeked out by the cutdowns too. And so long story short, we started talking about what if we could. These alts are so hard to come by, and sometimes people would buy one, they'd send it to me to cut it, and it would be garbage. You know, somebody else would have already jacked it up, or it would be cracked and glued back together, or just any number of things. And then on top of that, they were incredibly fragile. So somebody would send me one, you know, and you've got one, and you're cutting on it, whatever, and you don't pay attention, you drop it on the kitchen floor, and the thing shatters into five pieces. So there were lots of negatives to these alts that we were cutting, but they sounded awesome. And so kind of just sitting around the table at Duck Camp, you know, every winter there for a couple of years, the conversation just kind of always went to, you know, man, how cool would it be if we could produce these things? And then on top of that, you had just a ton of chatter on a bunch of the web forums. And MS Ducks was one of them. The main one that the chatter was going on was the Refuge Forum. And there was just tons and tons of cryptic chatter about, you know, these black duck callers that are flipped around backwards and they're incredibly loud and blah, blah, blah. And, man, I'm telling you, back then, I mean, not like this was terribly long ago. We're talking about 11 years ago, right? Blew these nobody to speak of. There'd be a few people in each WMA, more people in Biomeda than anywhere else, but outside of Biomeda, you never heard somebody blowing a cut down. There was no such thing as a Mondo. There was no such thing as really the only person that was commercially producing anything that resembled a cut down was Dave Jackson, DJ Calls. And he was doing that because he had been kind of the chief call maker, if you will, for the Old family for years and years. And he still had a business. When they shut their doors, he started his own calls, DJ Calls. And so he still made a keyhole style call. It was molded. It was a little different kind of plastic. But just being in Illinois, you know, I mean, there's a lot of duck cutters up there, but he didn't have the cut down following that existed in Arkansas now. I mean, of course, it didn't exist hardly in Arkansas back then. So anyways,
with all being said, look, people have been cutting down calls for years, but how big of a difference mid 2000s, and look, I know they've been cutting them down way before that. Before everybody in the woods had somebody in their party that had a cut down call, what was it like? That those groups that it was a big deal. Right?
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about calling against a group of nothing but J-frame callers and a large group of cut-down callers, it was a big difference, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was, but what you had, sure, it was, but not like, it's not magic. I mean, it's a volume equation. So what you had in a lot of the same WMAs, you know, Dave Donaldson, Biomeda, kind of the big popular ones where you got a lot of diehard guys that are going to hunt every day. What you had even then was you had guys that blew Main Street calls with a longer reed in them. You had guys that, I mean, even before kind of cut downs was a trend in the industry, you had guys really loud calls. And, I mean, they blew layers. They blew calls that kind of did the same thing that cut downs did. So I'm not going to sit here and say that it was like picking on, you know, taking candy from a baby because the other guys were, you know, hiding in the shadows and blowing little hiccups on a double reed, you know, quiet small bore call. Cause it wasn't like that. I mean, there were lots of groups that called really loud, and I mean, power calling didn't just start with cut downs. That's been going on a long time. But having said that, if you walk into the woods in Arkansas right now, every WMA kind of has a hot area, a busy area. And any given day, it may or may not be the best hunting, but any given day, it's going to be the most crowded area. Okay. Well, if you walk into any of those places on any given day during duck season right now, you can listen, and every group within every, you know, you can hear five or six groups calling, and every person in that group will be blowing some kind of a cut down call. I mean, there's Mondos hanging on everybody's lanyards, and there's a dozen other cut downs or alt modifications, or, you know, just it's taken on a life of its own, and that didn't exist 10 years ago. I mean, you had a few people, a few small groups that blew alts, and more of them in by me than anywhere else. But when you jump in the middle of a bunch of groups and your group knows how to blow a cut down, it did make a difference. It still makes a difference. It just, I don't want to say it's lost its impact, but there's just a lot more people doing it. Okay. And so when you're hunting in woods is different than a break or a lake or open water or a rice field. And the only reason it's different is because of limited visibility of the ducks. So you put ducks in an area where they can't see very well, and they don't have a choice but to listen. So if you're in a block of woods and there's nobody else there and the canopy up top is thick and you're calling loud at ducks, they're listening in a way that a duck flying over open water is not listening, because he doesn't have to. He is listening, but it's not a requirement for him to figure out where he's going. He can see everything he needs to see. And in an open water spread. So that's why you hunt bigger spreads of decoys, and, you know, like, you just do it different, you know? So a cut down is so effective, and was even more effective back then because you're hunting an area where they're listening, and listening ducks is at a premium, therefore calling is at a premium. So the guys who can call the loudest typically did the best. And that's why you had groups of guys blowing loud J-frames, you know, XLTs and daisy cutters and big bore J-frame style calls and layers and, you know, stuff like that. Man, we just got on a big tangent about calling ducks.
No, I think it was awesome.
Still there. So let's fast forward. Now we're summer, fall of 2009. My eyes absolutely falling apart. Lindy's spiraling out of control. I've been messing with duck callers for a while, a couple years now, and it's kind of we've started talking more seriously about, is there any way that we could get this made as an injection mold? All right. So in the midst of this summer of 2009, my buddy Wes said we need to figure out how to do this better than anybody else. And so we sat down. I was home over summer break. This was pre-I stuff, okay? We sat down together at dinner one night. We just, you know, went to get something to eat together and made a list of all the things that we thought were negative about an alt. Basically, if somebody asked me, why should I, you know, what are the reasons I would give somebody to not buy a keyhole alt? And we made this list, and it was, I don't know, 10 or 15 things long. It was things like material is fragile. It's brittle. It's not just fragile, but it's brittle in a way that it there's no flex to it. So if it gets bumped or gets banged or gets pinched, it's going to break. And so if you push the insert in too far into the wrong end, you know, it splits the barrel and blah, blah, blah. And they're inconsistent. The company had, you know, bazillion different molds over the generations, and some of them sound great when they're cut down, and some of them don't. Some of them sound not as good. And so we made this list of all the negatives. And then we went through and we made a list of what are all the positives. Well, the positives were things like it's a better material than what anybody makes a duck caller out of now. We didn't know what the material was. Some people called it Bakelite. Some people called it hard rubber. And, you know, but there was something special about the material. And then we, you know, the length of the exhaust was excellent. And the length of the tone channel was excellent. So those things all kind of contributed to big positives. So we made a list of negatives and we made a list of positives. And Wes said, why don't we pick like five generations of these duck calls? And he said, I've got a guy that can grind them down. He's a chemist. He can grind them down, and he can chemically analyze them. And we can go through the list of the chemical attributes and say what things are associated to the positive qualities that we listed and what things are attributed to the negative qualities that we attributed. So we had this list of basically of pros and cons. We did this chemistry analyzation of five different generations of olds, like from the different time periods, the different molds, whatever. And then we took our list and we literally did a matching. Okay, this chemical attribute right here, this causes this. It's great sound quality, but it's terrible in terms of density, and or it's terrible in terms of, you know, tensile strength, or, you know, it's fragile. So we just matched everything up, and then from there, Wes said, the reason I want to do this is because he said there are these people out there that do nothing but take chemistry analyzation and create customized cocktails of plastic blends. And I'm like, do what? And he goes, seriously, they have these catalogs of basically like plastic formulations. And so you tell them what you're looking for, whether it's UV resistance or heat resistance or tensile strength or density or just all the different things. You tell them, and they put it into a criteria, and they spit out a formula of plastic, and they have hundreds and hundreds of recipes basically that they've created for people. And so based on your needs and what your project, what you know, what attributes your project needs to have, they will match you with a custom blended plastic. So, all right, so this is all going on while I'm selling beer in St. Louis at Cardinal Stadium, okay, and doing seminary, all right? You still with me?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so this is going on, and we don't have any idea where this is going. We're literally goofing off with this because it's fun. Yeah,
let me ask you this. Did you absolutely find the perfect call? I mean, I know you went through all the chemistry, blah, 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 but is there one that was cut down just perfectly that sounded absolutely perfect that you kind of...
I'll answer that two different ways. There's one particular... I'm going to get this next part that I'm going to tell you a little bit wrong, so y'all are just going to have to cut me some slack. But
kind of the grandfather of all of your calls. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, yes is the answer to that, okay? I'll get there in just a second. But let me answer that question kind of two different ways. One is more of a general way, and one is more of a specific way. So the general way, the Olt family had an injection mold. They've had multiple ones. The best injection mold had multiple cavities in it, and those cavities were numbered. And certain generations of the calls, you can actually see the number of that cavity, the mold cavity, on the backside of the tone board. And some of them you can see it on the insert, on the exhaust end of the insert. They're different places. But the cavities were slightly different from one another. So basically, if you imagine a mold is two pieces of steel with a cavity dug out in them, and you slam those two pieces of steel together, you put the plastic in there, and it molds into a part, all right? Well, if you've got five cavities in a mold, let's just say, and those cavities are not were not cut with a computer guided tool, you can imagine that those cavities are going to be slightly different from one another. Okay, they're going to be real similar to one another, but they're not exactly the same. Well, so to answer your question in the general way, yes, there's definitely one particular cavity of one mold that I think is the best ult. And I get asked all the time, can you tell, you know, how do I find out if that's one of them? I have no idea how to tell you which one it is, but if I hold it and I look at it, I can tell you that's a good one. It's kind of like my dad always said about cash. When you run a business and you take cash in all day, dollar bills, like how do you know a counterfeit one? Well, you don't know how to tell somebody that you know that's a counterfeit. It's just when you've held thousands of good ones, real ones, the moment you touch a fake one, no matter how good the fake is, like, you know, it's a fake one. So for us, there was one mold, one cavity, one insert that I liked more than all the rest of them. And so if somebody sent me a call, sometimes I would have them send me three or four or five of them, and I would look at them and I'd say, this is the best one. I'll cut this one and send them the other ones back. And only cut one of them. So I think to answer your question, yes, there's one specific cavity of one of their molds that was better than the rest of them, and that's what we tried to pattern our call after. And yes, there is one specific call that I made my original cut around, but can we get to that a little bit later? Can I delay that?
Yeah, yeah.
Not quite there.
Yeah, yeah, thank you.
So it's summertime, we're screwing around with this injection mold thing, and not injection mold, I'm sorry. We're screwing around with how could we find a plastic that works as good as the material that the Ult family used. And we got all this cool information back. I still have the report of what all was in the material that the different generations of Ults were made out of. And so then we took that and we showed it to this chemist guy that made these custom plastic blended cocktail things. And the guy was like, oh man, we can definitely do that. You know, that's a this, that's a that. And next thing you know, we've got a sample of a 50-pound bag of this polycarbonate material that makes a great plastic. And we don't have any idea what we're going to even do with it. But this guy that Wes worked with was like, yeah, this is awesome. You know, you should definitely, this is it. This matches your criteria. So then we got to talking about, like, well, what are we going to do with that? And Wes said, well, we just need to make an injection mold. And I said, well, how do you do that? And he said, it's no big deal. You know, you take a concept and you get somebody to make it. And so he priced it out and it was like $40,000. And we were both like, well, you know, I guess that's over. Cause neither one of us have any money to speak of. I definitely don't. I'm steady, you know, I'm losing an eye and I owe United Healthcare 10 grand and he's not going to chip in, you know, for a $40,000 mold. So we kind of put it on the back burner, and somewhere right along in there is when my eye started really jacking up. Long story short, I'll fast forward. In October of that year, Lindy and I moved back to Memphis and we didn't have a place to live. But I couldn't do school. And so I went to the dean and I begged for, you know, to be let out of my classes and I asked him if I could get my money back. I was only a couple weeks into, it was really middle of September when I dropped out of classes. And I'd already paid a bunch of tuition money, and I just explained my situation, and I was in a housing contract, and they were very gracious and let us out of our housing contract and out of our tuition. And so we packed our stuff. I sent Lindy home with the girls, and I packed my stuff in the biggest U-Haul that I could find with a little bit of help of a couple people that lived close by up there in the apartments, and I drove that truck home solo with one eye, and had absolutely no idea what we were going to do next or where we were going to go or how we were going to make a living. And I mean, we didn't have a place to live. We had sold our house, I guess, 2 years before in Memphis. And
did both of you, I mean, I knew that I probably, look, I know there's got to be a little bit of fear there, but of the unknown, but there's got to be a sense of relief on both of you. Going home.
I mean, there
was a big deal.
There was a little bit, but at the same time, to be honest, I'm a pretty independent entrepreneurial kind of person, and I don't like losing very much. And I mean, here I am. I'm 29 years old. I've got two kids and a wife, and I'm moving back into my parents' house. And, you know, to be really candid, that was humiliating in a lot of ways. I don't know. Our next door neighbor growing up was a guy named Robert McCain. He's passed away now, but he was a grown adult single man that lived with his mom and dad until they died. And then he died. And, I just always kind of said, I'm not going to be that guy that goes back in as adult to my parents' house and lives under the same roof with my parents. Like it just didn't, I don't know. That just didn't feel right. But I found myself at a point where I didn't have another choice. I couldn't pay my apartment rent every month because I couldn't go work. And that was very much humiliating or humbling and difficult for me to swallow because I'm just not one of those people that thinks, that looks for a handout, I mean, you got to take care of your own, you got to take care of yourself. And I found myself in a place where I legitimately could not provide for myself or my family. And that was really hard to wrestle with mentally, emotionally, psychologically. That was really hard, but I had to make a choice between my wife's health and my health. And not know what that meant in terms of specifics, like how I was going to pay my bills, where I was going to live, and blah, what was I going to do with, I was 2 years into a 4-year seminary degree. What was I going to tell people? I just dropped out of seminary. I mean, that's not a real cool thing to say to people. it's not very socially acceptable. So we moved back and, we literally rented a storage unit and unloaded everything out of the truck into the storage unit, except for a couple duffel bags of clothing, and lived at Grammy and Granddaddy's house for a little while till we could kind of figure out what we were going to do.
Let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
Spiritually, where, I don't mean to take this side road, but I want to hear the detail of this.
That's fine.
Spiritually, I know that you're a very transparent person. You and Martin are a lot alike. That's why I like to talk to y'all. Because if I ask you, you're going to tell me. But
yeah. So
spiritually, God, what was that like? Confirmation, I was supposed to go back home.
Spiritually, it was... depending on the day, to be honest with you, some days I've shaken my fist at the good Lord and it's pretty hard to be in that situation and not say to God, I left a pretty dang good job and a comfortable home and didn't have any idea what I was going to do. And, I moved my family 400 miles away and I lived in a crummy apartment and learned how to translate the language that, your apostles wrote the Bible in 2,000 years ago, and this is what I get for it. I got no eye on the left side of my head that works, and I got, $10,000 in medical debt and a wife that can't function for 30 minutes without throwing up. And, what in the world did I do to deserve that? On one hand, that was where I was at, for sure, on certain moments of certain days. On the other hand, I have to be honest and just tell you that I was so sure about
God telling us that we were supposed to move to St. Louis and go to seminary, that I didn't feel like, I never thought that we made a bad decision. And I didn't really understand how to, I couldn't really formulate that into words, but there was a part of what was going on that I felt like was God's way of just telling us it's time to change direction and taking us down a different road. And one of my favorite verses in the Bible is in Proverbs. It says, man makes his plans, but God directs his footsteps. And I've always felt like that verse meant that not to oversimplify this, but that the first half of that, man makes his plans, and the second half, God directs his footsteps. It's like a lockstep relationship between man and God. Man makes his plans. It's like, it's my job to make plans for the future. And I'm supposed to, as a Christian man, to make those plans within the framework of what is acceptable biblically for a Christian man. And I feel like that's my responsibility. But at the same time, I have to be willing to own and be okay with God's side of that responsibility, which is the second half of that verse, which is that God directs his footsteps. And so from the time I was an early teenager, this was a verse that my dad and I talked about a lot, and kind of the way that I watched him live his life and the way that I've tried to live my adult life. And that being that we make our plans within the acceptable parameters of a biblical Christian lifestyle, but we're okay when God changes the course of that, because ultimately the second half of that verse says that God directs his footsteps. And so while in this situation, I was incredibly conflicted. I was frustrated, angry with where we were. My head hurt because my eyes competed with one another. And so just kind of with this constant headache, I was angry that this was the situation I was in. I didn't feel like this was Satan somehow, like just a random attack from the devil. What I ultimately took faith in was that somehow this was God directing our footsteps, that this was the second part of that verse, which was, I did my part, God's doing his part. And that didn't mean that it was going to be all, you know, all roses and bells and, you know, rainbows and, you know, and a happy, easy life. But what it meant was that, to me at that point in time, and at this point in time, was that I did what I was supposed to do. I am doing what I'm supposed to do, and that it's up to the Lord to direct where the actual footsteps take us. And so I took a lot of peace go ahead.
No. I want to ask you this. You spoke a lot about the present day then. What was going through your mind as you unload boxes into a storage building? You know, those first few days being back at home. As you look back on it now, and both of us know this as Christians, that God brings you down before he raises you up. And looking back on that now, do you think that humbling experience was preparing you for the greatness that you're part of today?
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, I guess you could say it that way, but I got to be honest, I don't feel like I'm been raised up to anything. I mean,
two figures in duck hunting. I'll say it. I don't care. You're one of the most looked up to figures in duck hunting. You can't deny saying.
But when you look at yourself in
something big.
But when you look at yourself in the mirror in the morning, you don't think that about yourself.
No.
Whether it's true or not. And so that's I would chalk that up to, I'm honored that you would say that, okay? I don't mean this to sound conceited, but that's an opinion that another human has, and while I'm honored and I appreciate that, where I shook out in this whole thing was I didn't necessarily believe that God was raising us up to do anything big. I just believed that he was changing the course of our life, and I didn't know where he was taking the course of our life, but I said I was okay with it. And so I didn't know the answer to where we were going next, but I just said, okay, Lord, I, you know, And so in a real way, like when I look back now, I got to tell you, I would have been a horrible pastor of people. I would have been a horrible preacher on Sunday mornings. I would have been miserable as a human. That would have been a horrible fit for the skill set that I have. And so I look back on that time, not as an attack from Satan. I look back on that time and think, holy cow. I mean, I just traded my left eye, if you will, for, what I'm doing right now is exactly what I was designed to do. I'm fulfilling the purpose that the good Lord put me on the face of this earth for. I'm happy when I'm making duck calls. And I'm happy when I'm managing people at the clinic. Like I'm doing these two different, very different jobs, but that in the strangest way fit who I am. And I look back at that part of our journey and just think that that's just how God directed our footsteps. That's how the road forked, and He showed us which side to go down, because I'd have picked the wrong side of that fork. You know, I don't mean that to be just disagreeing with you, Rocky, but that's, you asked me how I look at it, and that.
Let me rephrase that then. Let me rephrase it. Think back to 2006, 2007, Spencer Halford. Think about that guy. What if you'd been handed one of the Thunder game calls, 2006, 2007? Would you have been a good boss? Would you have been a good mentor? You know, would you have been somebody that a lot of people could look up to in duck hunting?
Probably not. I don't know. I mean, I was definitely, that's a valid point. You're definitely a different person, and you're, you know, the bumps in the road definitely make you who you are. So you're right about that. I agree.
You're one of the most visible people online today. You hear people talk about you at these shows, man. You walk up to Spence, man, he's a great guy. He'll show you and work with you on how to blow a call, blah, blah, blah. But I know that's what a lot of people do, but you always hear that about you. Would you have been that guy in 2006, 2007 without this huge pothole in the road?
Who knows? Probably not. I don't know. That's hard to think about, you know. Boy, the duck hunting was good in 2006 and 2007. Oh, we beat their brains in that year.
That's a good one.
That year, I have to tell you that year, I'll take a lot of flack for this, but I'm going to tell this war story. That year was, I believe it was 05, 06, something like that, that they first banned the spinners, robos, and they just said you couldn't have anything that made the with spinning wings. And so we called Game and Fish and asked about the Vortex machines, those things that, you know, spin like a helicopter, and said, you know, as long as they don't have ducks that the wings spin on, can we hunt with those? And they said yes. And I got to tell you, we carried one of those Vortexes into the middle of a big block of woods, and we held court for 2 weeks. I mean, it was ugly. At the time, Cabela sold those Vortexes, and they basically had a spinner on each arm. And we took the spinners off of them and put a fixed wing, like a rigid plastic, you know, mannequin duck, if you will, on each side of it. And we'd tape a shotgun shell to the inside of their head so that it kind of tilted to the middle and created some centrifugal force. And you'd hook that thing up to a car battery, and that son of a gun would spin. And we'd have the only gadget in the whole block of woods. And I mean, we hurt some feelings in those years.
That 2004 to 2009 period.
Mm-hmm.
Made my business.
Yeah.
But
so.
All right. So look, next week we're going to jump back into. You move back to Memphis. Leave it there. You move back to Memphis, and you got the chemistry back on the calls. A lot of stuff to cover from here on out because we're really about to jump into the Rolling Thunder part of the story. And I look forward to hearing that history. I love hearing history of a business. Not only of a person, but I love hearing the history of a business.
Yeah. Well, it's a good one. So we'll do that next week. That's fine.
Because there's a lot of hurdles. You talk about, you know, we learn how to walk slowly as kids, as babies. And it's the same way in business. There's so many hurdles that you, unknowns in business. You know how to make duck calls, but there's a lot of unknowns in turning that into a business. So it's tough. And I look forward to hearing that part of the story. Spence,
I hope
you have a good week until I talk to you the end of next week. 65 degrees. It should be a lot of fun. A lot of water.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, man. Sunshine. That's what you dream about.
All right, bud. Be good until I talk to you next week. Thank you again for being here. We want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.